Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. It's January 7th, 2006. It's the first LaRouche Show of the new year and we intend to make this a most happy year. We're going to begin 2006 with a review of the battle that was launched by Lyndon LaRouche literally about a month before the Bush administration first took office back in November and December of 2000. But which Lyndon LaRouche has been the leader in the United States to rid the United States of the person and the influence of Dick Cheney. It's not just that Cheney and his neocons are incompetent, which of course they are, but that they used the events of September 11th, 2001 to carry out a coup against the Constitution of the United States, attempting to impose on the nation a doctrine of the inherent power of the president to essentially do whatever he pleases, including throwing out our system of checks and balances, disregarding Congress and the courts. And we've seen that unfold again recently in the fight over John McCain's torture, anti-torture amendment. We've seen it over the NSA spying and the defiant attitude both Bush and Cheney have taken in defending their right to spy without going through the relevant courts and getting a warrant. So today we're going to hear from two of the authors of what is the next big bombshell to hit the country, The Children of Satan 4. It's a pamphlet that will be out this coming week, and our guests will provide the evidence that this doctrine of the unitary executive that Cheney has publicly endorsed comes from the crown jurist of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, namely Carl Schmitt, and that because of their support of this outlook, Cheney is impeachable, and to the extent that Bush continues to support it, he's putting himself also in the same firing line. And Lyndon LaRouche has told him to just shut up and let Cheney go first. So we'll be joined today by Ed Spanis, who's a member of the editorial board of the Executive Intelligence Review, and also by Barbara Boyd, who is has written for the Executive Intelligence Review and is also with the Constitutional Defense Fund. And then we'll be joined later by two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement for our regular weekly panel discussion, Stephanie Nelson of Houston and Spencer Cross of Seattle. So Ed and Barbara, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thank you, Harley.
How are you doing, Harley?
Ed, the latest report I have is that the new pamphlet, The Children of Satan 4, will be out in the streets of Washington and therefore in the halls of Congress by this Monday as part of the preparation for Lyndon LaRouche's webcast on January 11th. And this Children of Satan 4 makes the case why we have to get rid of Cheney as soon as possible. What's in the new pamphlet?
Well, to put it in precise technical terms, it shows that Cheney and his lawyers and these guys are a bunch of Nazis. That's the thrust of it. As you indicated, what it documents is that the doctrine of law, if you could call it that, which is cited by, used by Cheney and this gang of his legal mouthpieces in the White House and the Justice Department, is based upon Carl Schmitt, the crown jurist of the Third Reich. And what they... the doctrine that they refer to themselves as the unitary executive is in fact identical with the Führerprinzip, right, the leader principle advocated by Schmitt, which is an all-powerful executive, as they put it, or a dictator. So this will be, this is what's documented. And the second major thrust of the pamphlet is on Felix Rohatyn and Synarchy, and what is synarchism? Because these two things are really of a piece. The legal doctrine is part and parcel of a synarchist thrust, of which, for a synarchist economic dictatorship, of which Rohatyn is the best example. And one place where this comes together will be the documentation on Chile, particularly the 1973 Pinochet coup, where you see simultaneously the role of Felix Rohatyn in that coup and the role played by a strong follower of Carl Schmitt, which Barbara can tell you more about.
Jaime Guzman,
who is an explicit Schmittian, as one could call him, Schmidt-faced advisor to Pinochet, really probably controller. So you get both sides of this thing. You get the Schmidt Nazi side and the Rohatyn Nazi side coming together. So it's a very good illustration of how this works. So,
I guess one of the other stories that broke, ironically, in the Wall Street Journal this week is that Supreme Court designee Alito is also an open proponent of this idea of the unitary executive.
Exactly. I mean, this had been kicking around for a while, but this was the first major coverage of this in the so-called mainstream press, was this big Wall Street Journal article, which laid it out, you know, in pretty clear terms, that he is a proponent of this. When he was in the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, he authored a number of memos on this topic, on the need for, you know, unfettered, unlimited executive power. And one in particular that's going to come up, which is on this notion of the signing statement, which we can go into more. But this is particularly timely because when Bush signed the Defense Appropriations Bill on December 30th, he issued a signing statement, as he has done about 100 times now. But he said basically, you know, to Congress, screw you. I'm not going to enforce this law.
He used the actual words unitary
exactly.
executive.
Exactly. There's actually some academic did a count of this, and he's done this about 95 or 100 times. He's actually made signing statements using that terminology, which means that I reserve the right to ignore what Congress says, to ignore the legislation passed by Congress, and in this case, passed by Congress with a veto-proof majority. And, you know, this was not some provision that was snuck in the middle of the night, as often happens. This was something which was debated for months. Cheney came to the Senate, you know, threatened to veto. Everybody
you're talking about the McCain legislation, the amendment from John McCain with backing from others, including Senator Warner and Senator Graham.
Exactly.
The language of which said that the United States will stick with the old Uniform Military Code, which is no torture. And this is what Cheney was fighting against. And after the Congress passed it, the Senate overwhelmingly, Bush said, go ahead and just fill in what Bush said at that signing statement.
Yeah, well, when he signed the bill, he issues this statement, which says that I reserve the right to, in my role as commander-in-chief and head of a unitary executive and, you know, so on and so forth, I reserve the right to interpret this in light of my so-called constitutional responsibility as commander-in-chief, head of the unitary executive, which means that if I want to ignore this, this is a declaration that I will ignore this. He did this not only for the McCain Amendment, but also for some other provisions that were in there. But this really set off a firestorm among Republicans, right? Senator John Warner, John McCain, Lindsey Graham all issued a statement basically saying, we're going to, you know, you better not do this, and we're going to be watching you very, very closely.
That was a kind of warning statement.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then we had similarly from Leahy, Reed, and Rockefeller on the NSA spying.
Precisely.
A similar kind of warning.
Precisely. And what Lynn LaRouche said about that is that they're putting Bush and Cheney on notice. This is actually the opening shot for an impeachment drive. Because they're saying to Bush and Cheney, you are on notice that we expect you to follow the law. We expect you to cooperate as we in the Senate carry out our constitutional responsibility of oversight on the NSA surveillance. And if you don't cooperate, you know, there will be consequences.
And so we have this from leaders in both Democratic and Republican Party in the U.S. Senate.
Right. So it's shaping up to be a very interesting fight.
This is the LaRouche Show. You've just been hearing from Ed Spanas from the Executive Intelligence Review. The LaRouche Show is live on the web every Saturday, and we will take your email questions for our guests today. You can send emails to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And Barbara, let's turn to the question of Carl Schmidt right now. You have an article Dick Cheney's Eminence Grise, a profile of Carl Schmitt. What is this idea of the unitary executive, and how is Schmitt responsible for it?
Well, you have to go back in history a little bit. If you recall, in Lynn's famous 2001 press conference, when we first, or webcast, where we first analyzed what would happen in the Cheney-Bush administration, we said, because of the economic collapse, or Lynn said, we're bound to have something akin to a Reichstag fire. And a lot of people thought that was extreme at that point, but then again, 9/11 happened very shortly thereafter. And in the words of President Bush and Dick Cheney, everything has changed since then. You hear that over and over and over again, including our system of law. What Carl Schmitt did, he lived a very long life, unfortunately, coming out of World War I, which was a disaster in Europe, facing the economic disintegration of Germany under the Versailles Treaty imposed by the United States. He arrived as a professor of law very much of the idea of Thomas Hobbes, that there is no universal truth, that there is no anything other than an abstract notion of something called justice, and that the real reality of the human situation is the war of each against all. As he once said it, if man is not evil, then my ideas are evil. And basically what he did at the behest of sponsors from International Synarchy was to be the evil twin, if you will, to Hosmar Schacht, who ran the entire imposition of Nazi Germany from an economic standpoint through Montague Norman and the Bank of England. You had an economic policy which assured that Germany was brutalized down to the core of absolute total depression with constant austerity taken against the working class as opposed to what we had in the United States with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. And Schmitt came along and essentially said, well, what we have to do in this situation of economic emergency, an exceptional situation, something that positive law or the rule of law doesn't even recognize. We are in a situation where you assume, if you're a lawyer, that law handles every situation. Well, how does the law handle an economic crisis like the one we're in? Or how does the law handle the fact that we're about to be invaded by the evil Bolsheviks from Russia who could come across our border at any point? You see, we're in an exceptional situation. And out of that notion of the rule of emergency, the exceptional situation, he developed a whole theory or philosophy of law which said basically that sovereignty is not based on any principle, it's not based on any notion of truth, it's not based on any notion of anything universal, it's based on pure power. In other words, he who can decide what is to happen in the exceptional situation is the leader, is the sovereign. And the only use that constitutions have, which is very similar to what Bush is doing, is to delegate that power in an emergency to the executive.
So there's no check or balance, no legislative remedy. The executive can do whatever he thinks is justified.
Exactly, because the theory goes that the president, which you hear actually mimicked in this unified executive theory, the president is the only person who represents all of the people, is what Schmitt says. The legislature, or the parliament, he was actually a very adept populist, if you will, in terms of arguing that the German parliament was composed of people who allegedly were supposed to represent the people, but in reality represented nothing but a bunch of banks and other self-interested parties who in no sense could elevate themselves to take into account the needs of the nation as a whole.
Now, let's just take our listeners through a process of investigation here. What was it that, I know we've been working on this for years, but what was it that made it clear that Cheney was pursuing precisely this approach? Either of you can take the question.
Well, it's clearest. I mean, there's a history to it, which goes back 30 years. But to start, it became clear in the days immediately after 9/11, was Barbara referenced, this idea that 9/11 changed everything. Within days after that, Cheney made this statement on, I think it was NBC Meet the Press, about we're going to have to go to the dark side. Right, we're going to have to do things that we've never done before. And as what then, this only, a lot of what happened then has only really come out in the past year or two. But behind the scenes, when the first, of course, you had the roundups and the detentions of Muslims and Arab Americans in the United States. So that was pretty obvious. The president's order on military commissions issued in, I think it was in November of 2001, which at that point it was clear, you know, I found out in discussions with some military people that there had been, you know, a huge fight behind this, that Cheney's office was involved. What later came out, much more documented, was that there had been a huge brawl that Cheney and the Pentagon civilians versus the State Department, and in that case even the Justice Department, or some of the Justice Department people, over bypassing the traditional military law court-martial system and setting up these kangaroo court military commissions, which have never, in fact, even gotten off the ground.
Well, Ed, let me just play devil's advocate for a moment. And to defend Cheney's position, you have to be the devil's advocate, as we correctly title it, Children of Satan.
I hope. Give it your best try, Harley.
All right. Well, I'll try it. What about their argument that they know better that there's a serious threat, that the country is not prepared to deal with it, and therefore they have to have extraordinary supra-constitutional or unconstitutional means to address it?
Well, my question to you, Mr. Devil, would be, what war has this country ever been engaged in where that was not the case? Every war is a new kind of war. Every serious war is an extraordinary threat. Every war is a new kind of an enemy. And, you know, if these guys are going to say that bin Laden and a bunch of guys dwelling in a cave in Afghanistan are more of a threat than the Nazi war machine, than the Japanese were in World War II, or you can go back any number of times in history, I mean, just on the face of it, it's an absurd argument. And it's obvious when they make that kind of an argument that they've got another agenda.
Well, let's just follow that to one more point then. They said that they did not go, for example, to get warrants for wiretaps to FISA, the special court that was set up in the late 1970s to prevent precisely what they're doing. They didn't go there because they had to act quickly to move aggressively to counter what could be imminent terrorist attacks. Is there any evidence that what they did made us safer?
Absolutely not. And not only that, it's a total lie. Because FISA has tremendous flexibility. It has emergency provisions. You don't have to go to the court first. If you have a declaration of war, which they argue that the use of force resolution is, you have a 15-day period, I think it is, when you can go on an emergency basis. So that's a total lie. The idea that FISA left some wiggle room is also a total lie. I mean, FISA was unambiguous, and Cheney knows this because he was there at the time fighting this stuff. It was unambiguous that there are no exceptions to domestic surveillance that do not go through FISA, either FISA or, if it's a criminal case, through what's called Title III wiretaps. And I mean, I've been in a number of discussions with people over the past weeks where they, people who were around at the time, who say this is unambiguous, that, you know, there's no hedging around this stuff. And you may have seen that the Congressional Research Service issued a report yesterday coming to the same conclusion, that FISA, that refuting the legal justification put out by Bush and Cheney and Gonzalez, Attorney General Gonzalez, saying that the use of force resolution justified this or something. It's all lies, and they know it's all lies.
So the fact that it's such blatant lies makes it clear that there's another intention.
Another intention,
and as yeah. Paul Craig Roberts said this week, if we've come this far and people have tolerated this much from this administration to date, think of another terrorist incident, which must be what's being planned, and at that point, you know, Katie barred the door in terms of the Constitution. And that's exactly where this thing is potentially headed. We have them against the wall at this point, but you know, Cheney is a very dangerous cornered animal, and, you know, essentially the only conclusion you can come to when you look at the law which exists, the president's and his statements and everything else, is that they've got to be planning something similar to that as a final sort of coup de grace to the Constitution.
Well, Barbara, as we've discovered recently, there are a number of people in the Senate who are quite bright and at least have bright staffs and are looking at these kinds of questions. To what extent do you expect that the question of the unitary executive will become an issue, given that it was brought up by Schumer the other day? Do they understand the importance of Carl Schmitt? Is this something that's starting to get through?
It's starting to get through. However, they don't totally understand it because we've had as one law review article I recently read, it was quite provocative, points out since, you know, Lynn has made a point constantly of the Truman administration as being the start of this decline of the United States legally and in all other senses. And, you know, what you've had since the Truman administration is one declaration of emergency after another, with a Congress which has been somewhat prone and a judiciary which at various times has not really distinguished itself that well. Like you mentioned earlier, the Japanese internments, for example. So the problem is going to be that we have to drive home the fact that Carl Schmitt represents something very bad in the United States, and that the revival of Carl Schmitt isn't really accidental, and that to really come to grips with what our Constitution is really all about, you have to be able to answer Carl Schmitt. And most of what our friends on the Democratic Party side have as a legal background at this point is something akin to the rule of law and logical positivism as basically what the law is supposed to be about, and that's not what the Constitution is about. For example, you cannot, if you had to have a debate between the rule of law and what you just brought up as devil's advocate, Harley, what is an extraordinary situation and how do you actually handle that? If you don't understand the Constitution being something about a principle, i.e., first and foremost, the General Welfare Clause is a principle at the heart of the Constitution, not some kind of structural mechanism, simply of checks and balances, which is reiterated over and over again, you're not going to really be able to deal with extraordinary situations in a way that's truthful and that actually rediscovers what our founders were fighting through during those particular times. Remember, the Constitution comes out of our revolution.
Right.
Which was an extraordinary period if there ever was
one. This is the most ridiculous thing. These characters make these arguments. Well, in wartime, you have to, that's extraordinary. You have to suspend the Constitution. Well, it came out of the cauldron of the Revolutionary War and a post-revolutionary period in which the British were constantly trying to, you know, instigate and subvert the revolution and the new republic. And it was written it's an extraordinary constitution for extraordinary circumstances. And this argument that, well, everything changed after 9/11 because we were attacked. For crying out loud, what was going on back then?
Well, Ed, tell us now about one of the groups that we're looking into and that we are going to dismantle with this new pamphlet, the Federalist Society, which is a kind of almost, to most people, an underground revolutionary movement burrowing into the institutions. What do we have on the Federalist Society?
Well, a lot of dirt. I mean, it's ironic because, I mean, in one level, they've been very open, but people have just tolerated this stuff. The last time it really came to any significant attention that I recall was during the impeachment, you know, drive against Bill Clinton, when you remember you had the vast right-wing conspiracy, and they, of course, were right in the middle of it, but then it sort of faded back, and every once in a while you get an article saying, well, to be a judge or to have a significant appointment in this administration, you have to be, you know, vetted by the Federalist Society. But this is what they, in fact, were set up to do almost 25 years ago, to be a recruiting and training ground and also a sort of hiring hall or clearinghouse for this anti-constitutional outlook that you expressed in various ways, expressed as the Scalia, Thomas, the originalist type of idea. The extreme, it's ironic because these guys, in fact, are extreme anti-federalist. They should be sued for product infringement for calling themselves the Federalist Society. What came up last year is the Constitution in Exile movement. People who say that we haven't had a constitution since FDR. He destroyed it, and we're going to restore it, which they mean restoring. In fact, what they're talking about restoring is the Confederate Constitution. It's much closer to what they're talking to. And now the unitary executive idea.
Which Schmidt advocated, by the way. Yeah. He actually comes out in favor of the Confederacy as being a superior notion of the United States to what we actually have.
So what the Federalist Society is, it operates on two levels. On one level, it's a 40,000 members, big conferences and stuff like that, very public. But on the other hand, there's sort of an inner core of this thing, which is a subversive fifth column. And it targets the courts. It targets the law schools for recruitment and targets the Justice Department, particular places in the Justice Department, like the Office of Legal Counsel, which, not surprisingly, is where the torture memos come from and who have been the proponents of these signing statements and the unitary executive doctrine. So
now
they
both Roberts and Alito are members in good standing, are they not?
Yeah, well, members in elusive category. What you really have to look at is participants, or activists and stuff like that. Someone can say, "Well, I'm not a." Roberts said, "I'm not a member," but then you look at him. It's the old saying: "If it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck." it must be one.
And do you think this will become an issue in the Alito hearings?
Well, it's interesting that you've had a shift, as you indicated, over the past week, with increasing attention on and people explicitly now talking about the unitary executive. I mean, not only Schumer gave the press conference, it was actually a briefing he gave on Thursday, but Leahy, even Kennedy came out talking about this. And now, I mean, when Schumer talked, he said that this question of the unitary executive, the presidential powers, executive power, is going to be the first issue we take up. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, their witness list yesterday, and in their listing of issues, the first issue they now mention is the question of presidential power and the role of the courts in respect to this. So there clearly has been a shift on this, but you still have, a lot of baggage of, Roe versus Wade and all this stuff, which people are going to come in there and, bang away on their hobby horse. And then the deeper questions that Barbara alluded to, of people can use the words and know something now about unitary executive, but do they understand the deeper implications of this?
Well, I think this just highlights the importance of this new pamphlet, The Children of Satan 4, that we'll be getting out, that this is something that is going to, in addition to the Week of Action coming up, and on January 11th, Lyndon LaRouche's webcast, which will be 1 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouchePact.com. And everyone listening today should not only listen on the 11th, but should organize people for that. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with the LaRouche Youth Movement panel. This is the LaRouche Show, and we're here on January 7th, 2006, taking up the question of restoring the Constitution to the United States. We will take your calls or your emails on radio@larouchepub.com. radio@larouchepub.com. I also want to give out the phone number where you can call in and order copies of the pamphlet as it comes out, 3258. 888-347-3258. This pamphlet will probably be the end of Dick Cheney as vice president and the beginning of a new debate on the proper kind of constitutional economic policies. So once again, Lyndon LaRouche will be addressing the nation January 11th. It will be a webcast on LaRouchePack.com and organize for that. We're getting a couple of questions coming in, but I want to bring in the two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Let's start with Stephanie Nelson from Houston. Hi, Stephanie. How are you?
Good afternoon. Fun
Do you have a question or some comments?
Well, I didn't quite formulate exactly a question, but I've been taking some journeys to the dark side myself lately, and reading some Nietzsche and some as the leading existential philosopher, because in trying to discuss the importance of all these developments and this fight around the Constitution and the historic implications of them, a lot of young people, right, people in my generation, don't really have a concept of history which would make this fight seem to have any relevance to their life. And I think that's a product of an existential culture. And so I want to provoke a certain self-consciousness of this existentialism in members of my generation, including members of the organization. So if anyone has something they could add to that discussion, like a truthful idea of history as opposed to the Fukuyama end of history idea, which actually justifies a global tyranny.
Well, Barbara, Ed?
Well, I mean, I think basically Lynn spends most of his writings doing precisely that in terms of locating, the actual truth in history movement, starting with Plato, proceeding through the Renaissance, and then, the culminating point of which was the American Revolution. The Siddarchy was basically founded by a financier faction in Europe who were dedicated Satanists, really, and existentialists, who wanted to reverse the progress which was made during the Renaissance, reverse the entire idea of the American Revolution, and go back to basically a feudal system, where the bankers would be the world's cops, so to speak, something which they're very much doing right now. And the only reason why you could have, I mean, Stephanie, what you're doing is extremely provocative, because the only reason why you could have a revival of someone who should have been tried at Nuremberg, like Schacht and Schmidt both were interviewed by the same prosecutor and released by the same prosecutor, but the two of them could be called almost the twin ideological architects of Nazi Germany. You have a revival in the United States where the same foundations that fund the Federalist Society have funded, the promotion of Carl Schmitt as a political genius of the First Order. The same foundations also, not ironically, fund the so-called Nietzsche revival in the United States. In other words, Nietzsche was promoted very much towards the baby boom generation in particular, and also there was a huge Nietzsche revival in the United States back during the 90s, which again, is based on a very conscious promotion of existentialism, a very conscious promotion of the idea that God is dead, so to speak, and even people who claim to be Christians, don't claim that they do it by any process of human rationality or reason. They claim to only do it through a process of absolute irrational revelation. So what you're doing, I laud, but you should know that Nietzsche has played a very critical role in all of this stuff, and self-consciously so. Robert Morgenthau, who was one of Schmidt's key proponents in the United States, a student of his, Hans Morgenthau, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of New York at this point, but Hans Morgenthau, all right, from the University of Chicago, Henry Kissinger's mentor, in foreign policy, the leader of the so-called realist school of foreign policy, was a proponent of Carl Schmitt's, a student of Carl Schmitt's in the United States, and also, not accidentally, a complete devotee of Friedrich Nietzsche.
Barbara, what is the connection, just so people know, of Schmidt and Leo Strauss, whose name became quite familiar from the original publications of Children of Satan 1?
Well, Leo Strauss was a student of Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt actually, Strauss was Jewish, he didn't fit in with where Schmitt was going ultimately. He arranged for him to get a Rockefeller Foundation scholarship to come to the United States. They collaborated on Schmitt's key work, which is called The Concept of the Political. And in fact, Strauss wrote the introduction to that work. I discovered recently that they collaborated even far beyond the period when Schmidt was the guy who spent all of his time writing the legal doctrines to justify each step in Hitler's total ascension to power. You know, Schmidt wrote the justification for the enabling laws. He also wrote the justification for the Night of the Long Knives, in which Hitler slaughtered all of the opponents to him. And even after that, Leo Strauss and Schmidt collaborated on Strauss's book on Hobbes. So, you know, basically, he remained a devotee of Carl Schmitt all his life because Schmitt is a hot topic, or was back then, among all circles in the United States. We hadn't revived him as the greatest theoretician of the 20th century, which some people would now put him at. That was very much a quote-unquote hidden dialogue. In fact, there's a book by that name called Carl Schmitt and Leo Strauss, The Hidden Dialogue. So you had all of these people who claimed to be Straussians. Scott Horton, who has been interviewed by EIR and is a prominent international lawyer, argues that really it's not the Straussians who are there. It is the Carl Schmitt who was mediated into the United States by Leo Strauss and the University of Chicago, which is actually functioning in terms of how this administration acts.
So while it's hard to talk about an intellectual influence on someone like Dick Cheney, for whom there's no evidence that he has any intellect, certainly the people who are the Addingtons and the John Hughes and others, they would be very conscious of this question of Schmidt.
They would be. Michael Adeen most certainly would be, who's a key advisor and to Cheney, who advocates universal fascism. You know, he's surrounded by people. Henry Kissinger, for example, who probably, you know, set into motion most of the insane foreign policy which the United States has had in the post-war period, actually invited Schmidt to come and join the journal at Harvard University during William Yandel Elliott's seminars.
We will have the text of that letter in the pamphlet coming out on Monday.
I was just going to say that if you're following this discussion at home and you're listening to it and it's causing your circuits to blow, you have to get this pamphlet and get it to your congressmen, get it to the Democratic and Republican leaders in your area. The LaRouche Youth Movement will be bombarding Washington, D.C. early this week, and then as it gets out into the field, it's going to be all over the country. Let's bring in Spencer from Seattle, who Spencer is a student I know of American history and has probably been listening quite intently. Spencer, you have anything you want to bring up?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one quick thing. Kind of along the questions Harley and Ed were bringing up at one point about the whole argument of the post 9/11 world and how that allows them to, you know, so-called fight terror beyond the means of the Constitution. One thing we run into in organizing politically the population of the campuses and just general sort of urban centers is that same sort of line. And one thing that's useful in showing people how that's not exactly the case is something we have done a fair deal of investigation into, which was the Frank Olson case, the 1975 case of, and you can obtain it through the sources. Harley said it earlier, the website or the phone number, to get a copy of an EIR where we investigate this more in depth. But it's the short of it is the 1975 support of torture from people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, well before the so-called War on Terror. But I will add that from some of our discussions in our Seattle local up here about how things have been going as far as our response and such, a lot of our context recently with some of the recent revelations in the, you know, Chuck Schumer attacking the concept of the unitary executive and some of the sort of the escalations against this same sort of legal doctrine that's been discussed this whole program, that our contacts are making the direct connection saying, yeah, we thought that was you guys. we thought that was Lyndon LaRouche and his taking hegemony within the better elements of policy shapers at this point. My question, anyone could really take this up, is how do we really sort of amp up the escalation with the recent Alito flank we've been talking about, and obviously the imminent collapse of Dick Cheney while still sort of keeping our eyes on the economic recovery?
Well, the fact that this has come out with Alito is useful, and we're going to hit him, have hit him, and will hit him hard. But the point is that we have to go way, way beyond that. That's useful up to a point. But as Lynn was stressing today in a discussion with Jeff Steinberg, he said we're going to have to do the heavy lifting on this. You know, you're going to get these senators who they'll talk unitary executive, and they may talk about the Federalist Society, and they'll talk about, you know, excessive presidential powers and things like this. But we're the ones that have to show that these guys are a bunch of Nazis and document it, as we have done in this pamphlet and will continue to do. So we have to take it to a much deeper level than they are prepared to do at this point. I mean, it's quite useful that this has come out. One comment that Lynn also made was that when the Wall Street Journal put this story out on, Thursday, I guess it was, this big front-page story about Alito and the unitary executive, they didn't really realize what the consequences of this would be because of what we have done, right, on this topic and what we've done on this and the Rohatyn side of this thing, which is something they would not expect us to hit them with. So, you know, the contacts are right? What's coming out now is reflective of a process that we've set in motion, and it's going to continue to be shaped by what we've set in motion. But then ultimately beyond that, as we were discussing earlier here, all of this is sort of taking out the garbage, right? Getting rid of these guys, Cheney, Addington, Bush if necessary. This isn't the solution to the problem. It's just sort of the precondition for solving the problem.
And Ed, I want to come back to that in just a moment, but I think it is useful to bring up one other side of cleaning out the garbage, and this is one that Stephanie's been very much involved in, which is the breaking stories of this week with Tom DeLay.
Oh, yes.
Which is former good buddy Jack Abramoff, who DeLay seems to have forgotten conveniently. But Stephanie, what's the mood in Tom DeLay's district right now? Are they ready to clean out the garbage?
A lot more than there used to be, is for sure. There's a general, just in the entire area around here, a real excitement about any breaking news that has to do with Tom DeLay. I think today he announced that he's not going to try to become majority leader again.
Yeah, he said that after a petition was circulating by Republicans, his old friends, who were trying to distance themselves from him. But yeah, go ahead, Stephanie.
Yeah, so it's made the event that his opponent, the Nick Lanson, who has announced himself as a candidate for running against Tom DeLay. People at those events are much more excited. There's a clear optimism, and people in his district. A long time ago, when some of the ethics scandals and stuff first started to break, people were like, "Oh, this is just party politics. He's just under attack. You guys aren't biblically directed enough." We got told all kinds of things, but now there's less and less people who can deny what a crummy guy he is.
Okay, well, and the story is going to continue to unfold as Abramoff has pled guilty in two different courts, and the conditions for him not going to prison for 60,000 years, I think, is that he has to continue to give up everything that he was involved in illegally, including people like Congressman Ney of Ohio, Doolittle in California, and, of course, Tom DeLay. Well, we've got about a little more than 15 minutes to go. This is the LaRouche Show. We're discussing the imminent release of the new special report, Children of Satan 4, focusing on the corruption, the absolute cesspool of corruption and filth around the Cheney doctrine of the executive power, the inherent power of the presidency. But as Ed brought up earlier, there's a second side to this, which is once we clean these guys out, we've got an economy that's been destroyed. And I think we saw for the first time in the last few days some of the Democrats doing things that they should have been doing for years, like Robert Reich raising the point that what good is it if GDP goes up, but the lower 80% are increasingly desperate economically? And, of course, again, our people who read New Federalist and the EIR or log on to LaRouche PAC will recognize that that's something that Lyndon LaRouche has been saying. But a lot of this is focused around Felix Rowett. And let me just mention one thing from California, because we have the puppet of George Shultz, Arnold Schwarzenegger, was given a new script this week. He's dropped his Schultzian austerity, the budget cuts, at least he seems to have, and instead is calling for massive infrastructure. But we know now that this is not a change, that in fact Shultz and Rowett have been partners in fascist policy before. Ed, why don't you give us a little bit of the background of this?
Well, let me first pick up with what I was saying a minute ago, which is that this question of after we take out the garbage, what do we then do? It will be addressed by Lyndon LaRouche heavily in the webcast on Wednesday, which will be the question of the economy, what's necessary to do to save the machine tool principle, saving the auto sector, New Bretton Woods reorganization, and so forth. That will be a big focus of Lynn's address on the webcast with accompanying animations to sort of dramatize some elements of this. As you were saying about Arnie and his becoming a born-again advocate of infrastructure, which is the way he, as I understand it, he presented himself in the State of the Union address.
He said, I heard your message. You right. don't want partisanship. We must grow, so let us grow.
I was almost moved to tears by it, I tell you. But this brings up the Rohatyn plan, this what he calls the National Infrastructure Commission, which is the counter-gang proposal, the synarchist counter to what LaRouche has been doing and also what's developing out of the Pelosi-Reid initiative presented in her speech at Harvard in December. What Rohatyn has been proposing for some time, and he sort of resurrected this again just recently, is a plan, I think he calls for $50 billion infrastructure plan financed by special bonds. And it's basically a banker's it's a banker's infrastructure program to keep things as they are while sort of patching up, some of the worst damage, which is at a certain point even they realize something has to be done on this. What Arnie's proposal is appears to be something very modeled on this.
Yeah.
This is not LaRouche's proposal, in which he says part of taking out the garbage is also to clean up this debt bubble. And you've got to put the system through a bankruptcy. There is so much speculative paper, debt, garbage floating around out there in the financial system, hedge funds, derivatives, all this type of thing, that the precondition to be able to do any sound actual infrastructure and relaunching manufacturing, the machine tool industry, this sort of thing, is to straighten out the financial system, put it through bankruptcy, where you're starting with a credit system of government-sponsored credit system in which you're more or less taking a clean slate, as you would in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. What Rohatyn and this synarchist proposal is to do, a moderate amount of say, building of highways and things of this sort, but in the context of keeping this debt-ridden, bloated financial system intact for the bankers. So the two proposals actually could not be more different, even though, at first blush, some people might say, oh, gee, that sounds like something you guys have been proposing. It was interesting when Rohatyn resurrected this a couple of weeks ago, the reaction among people in the Senate and on Capitol Hill was, oh, this is what you guys have been talking about, in the sense of that this is, a fascist type of economic proposal. Mm-hmm. This is not LaRouche's proposal. They've been educated enough that they recognized it immediately for what it was.
I'd like to ask Barbara on this, that if you look at the proposal, They are talking about roads. Well, Hitler built some roads also.
Yeah, right.
You had mentioned earlier, Barbara, the coherence between Schmidt and Schacht. I guess that's what we're seeing.
Absolutely. I mean, what happened was, you know, that basically what Schacht said is that in order to sort of impose the last round of austerity and maintain the power of the international banking system at this point, particularly the synarchist bankers, it was going to be necessary not just to have, to impose austerity from above through state power, but to basically you had to actually get the people to agree with it, which was the purpose of the Nazi political movement. And the whole, saying to the German people at that point of absolute despair, what we're going to do is create a new German nationhood, which is really based on you. There was, coming back to what we were discussing before, what Schmidt said is, look, you can go around this constitution we have in Germany and still have a perfectly legitimate government under the dictatorship. What you can do is very similar to something you have out there in California, is that you can have Hitler actually have plebiscites, the dictator has plebiscites, direct referenda by the people for his policies. And in fact, that's what Hitler did a couple of times in Germany to give legitimacy to these actions.
Well, the difference is, of course, here Schwarzenegger got clobbered largely through the work of the LaRouche Youth Movement. And Ed, I saw Lyndon LaRouche made a comment saying that if you look at what's being said by Leahy, Reed, and Jay Rockefeller and others, that there is an opposition, an institutional opposition to the imposition of fascism in the United States.
Right. And he noted that yesterday, and particularly in a different, slightly different context, which was the town meeting held in Arlington, Virginia, sponsored by Congressman Jim Moran, in which the featured speaker was Representative John Murtha. And this was really a qualitative type of shift where there was something like 1,000 people showed up. The room could only hold 450. And the mood of the crowd was impeach, impeach, impeach. And congressmen, as most congressmen do these days, say, well, that's a very complicated procedure, and you got a Republican-controlled Congress, and how can you do that? And the crowd was saying, impeach him, and our people were saying impeach Cheney first, and the literature was flying out of their hands, our people, as they were saying that. So what Lynn said about that was that he said, this is very important because the American people smell fascism in what these guys are doing. And the American people have never submitted to fascism, as the Germans did in the 1930s. And so you're going to see a fight which can take place because of really of the character of this country and what it represents since its founding, when people get a whiff of this stuff. And people are getting a whiff of this stuff right now.
Ed, we have a question from the Detroit office about Victoria Tensing, I think is her name, a former DOJ prosecutor. She's been all over the media defending the Bush administration. They want to know if you know if she's a member of the or tied to the Federalist Society.
Joined at the hip. I think absolutely. In fact, I mean, Barbara can tell you too.
Victoria is a very interesting character. She, yes, she's tied to the Federalist Society. She's tied to every kind of evil notion of law which exists in this country at this point. She's part of the she's part of the Straussian apparatus, to be specific, and she headed the fraud division of the Department of Justice and also the terrorism division of the Department of Justice during the LaRouche prosecutions, and she played a very prominent role in the prosecution of Lyndon LaRouche. She was John Markham's immediate boss.
So the Detroit office had a whiff of the fascism we've been discussing.
Yeah, you got it. She's always trotted out as a spokesman for this crowd on these, as an objective legal commentator on these types of issues. She was one of the first to come out on the Valerie Plame investigation, almost as a defense lawyer for, Scooter Libby and Karl Rove.
Yeah.
I think she probably is.
There's another question that gets back to the economics. Santiago Hillaret sent an email asking about the Steelworkers Union leadership blasting Dick Cheney, where Cheney had this photo op at a Harley-Davidson plant yesterday, and most of the to talk about how great the economy is, and the steelworkers union boycotted it. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, it's just very interesting because what they said, and I think there's now wires out on this in a press release, but we called them up from here when we saw that Cheney was going out there. He somehow thought that if people manufactured motorcycles, they must be a bunch of bikers. And this was the only crowd he thought he could find that might still agree with him. He seems to have worn – he's even worn out his welcome among the military. But the steelworkers union, the union local out there, said, you know, how dare these guys who have destroyed manufacturing in this country come in here and try and do sort of a red state photo op to justify, you know, their political agenda. And he said, especially in light of the fact that you just had this tragedy, the deaths of these miners in Pennsylvania because of the policies of this administration. So, I mean, that was a pretty strong statement.
Well, and apparently Cheney was there with a cane as one of his cloven hooves, apparently, were the problem.
Exactly.
We're down to about 4 minutes. Spencer, I want to see if you had anything else you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, kind of along the lines, again, of what Ed was saying, is that on the campuses, we're actually going parallel to what Lynn is saying. We're trying to put the universities through intellectual bankruptcy reorganization. Mostly with, we've been gauging some of the responses we had with the, like I said earlier, the COS3 pamphlet, the Children of Satan 3, on the question of the culture. But even just 2 days earlier this week, we went up to Western Washington University, which is, it's a campus, they read our material, and we don't get up there as often as we should. But getting back to some of the context the past couple of nights about the Codriscoll we're having and LaRouche's webcast next Wednesday, it was interesting that the pattern of responses, it was, you know, pretty scattered, but a lot of it was very, very similar responses, as in bringing up certain slanders, but all, like, the same wording and the same, almost the same, like they're reading off a script or something as to why they weren't interested.
Mm-hmm.
So we're definitely going to hit it up next week and see what kind of, there's something going on, and I think a lot of it is just from the nature of how provocative the education pamphlet is. Obviously, we're going into university telling them there's a dark age in education, but it's interesting to note that we're having a much larger effect than I think we even realize sometimes.
One thing which I think people should keep in mind in looking at what's going on campus is that I came across this when I was researching the grants which have been made to Schmidt and the Federalist Society, and I noticed very prominently that Lynn Cheney's Campus Watch, which is the policeman in terms of LaRouche's ideas on campus, has been funded extravagantly by the Bradley Foundation and the very same people who are funding the Federalist Society and the Carl Schmitt Revival in the United States.
Well, Barbara, you probably remember what Lynn once said, that he has a very small group of enemies.
That's right.
But he also said, don't say something bad about LaRouche if you have something to hide.
There you go.
And they got a lot to hide.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the last couple of minutes. Ed, I'll leave it to you to summarize. We've got this pamphlet coming out. We have the webcast coming up, and I want to give the number one more time for people to call in to get the pamphlet, 888-347-3258. But why don't you just set the scene? Lynn will be addressing the nation and the world January 11th on economics and defeating fascism. What should people be looking for?
Well, be looking for some very, you know, hard-hitting continuation of the exposures of what we've been doing, but knowing LaRouche, it won't be just a continuation of what we've been doing. He will be opening up new flanks on this. And as I indicated, I believe that his focus will be on this question of, after we take out the garbage, how do we actually solve the problem? So he will be addressing the question of the saving the automobile industry, the machine tool principle. I know he will be talking about this study recently done on Baltimore, on the death zones in Baltimore, the, you know, nonlinear, you know, connection between poverty and disease. And so we'll be coming out with this pamphlet on Monday on Children of Satan 4. Within days of the webcast, we'll get out another pamphlet with a transcript and Q&A on that. And then shortly after that, there will be a third pamphlet coming out by LPAC on a new paper Lynn has done on the capital budgeting, which will probably include the Baltimore study, Strategic Bankruptcy. So there's a lot to come, And people should definitely plan on tuning in on Wednesday for the LaRouche webcast.
That's going to be at 1 p.m. Eastern time on LaRouchePAC.com. Ed Spanis, Barbara Boyd, thank you very much for being with us today. Stephanie Nelson and Spencer Cross, thank you also. And everyone should tune in this Wednesday to LaRouche's webcast. This has been the LaRouche Show. Thank you for joining us.